When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Interesting day of reading all of the stories about those greedy workers. Can you believe how greedy they are? Can you believe? Do you know how greedy they are? Do you know they want a 40% raise? Did you hear they want a 40% raise? How dare they? Just another day in corporate-controlled media telling us how greedy these working people are. And it's, again, not surprising. It's what we see time and time again. But I do find it quite interesting. Do you get the sense that I do? That there are some that really don't want working people to have any sense of power, any sense of the ability to change things, to make things better. Do you ever get that sense that there's something out there kind of just, well, holding you down, pushing you back, sliding everything to one end of the table? Yeah, I look at the Chicago Tribune. You know, I was looking at the editorial page. The bold headline. And it's one of these things where you just go, who's over there? Now, understand, the Chicago Tribune is one of the, you know, country's, you know, most well-respected newspapers. Headline, Sean Fain is a belligerent UAW boss. There could be big trouble ahead for U.S. automakers. Now, never mind the fact that, you know, over the last decade, the big three have pocketed a quarter of $1 trillion. Never mind that. Don't let the fact get in the way. Never mind the fact that over that period of time, they have bought $66 billion in stock buybacks. I saw that number and you know, I know they're doing 5 billion now, but over the 10-year span, $66 billion in stock buybacks, which again, when a company says we're going to buy our stocks back, there's really one reason for that. And that's to pump up the share price so that the executives make a little bit more money. You dole more of it out to the investor class. They do better. But what it's really saying is that they have no productive use for that profit other than to dole it out to the wealth class, other than to dole it out to the shareholders and to the executives. Now, in years past, in decades, let's go decades past, when unions were strong across the country, when we had 35% union density in this country, and that's in the private sector, if you were to do that, working people would have taken to the streets. And surprise, surprise, what are we doing now? You're seeing people taking to the streets. I think people have had enough of it. And for me, I keep looking in this moment and going, I'm optimistic. I'm seeing people who have had enough. I'm seeing people who are saying the struggle is too much. We're gonna do something about it. But I also see the Republican Party, the party who I say quite frequently hates working people, because they do, evidently. Look at their policies. And I used to always say, look at what they do. Look at the policies that they moved. Look at the things that they do. But now, more importantly now, listen to what they say. And yesterday we talked about Nikki Haley and her giving Joe Biden credit for the strike. And I'm sure he will take credit for that because he is the most pro-union president of my lifetime. If you promote unions, those people are going to want better wages, hours, conditions. Yeah, Nikki, that's the point. And then today you've got Tim Scott. And I don't know what it is about South Carolina. Yeah, a crazy former governor who, you know, says she wears pointy-toed shoes so she can kick union people. You've got Tim Scott, the senator from South Carolina, who at a campaign event, because I don't know if you know it or not, he's running for president. His polling numbers aren't great, but he's running. Give him credit. He's giving it a go. But he had this to say. And this is, again, one of those things where you just go, listen to the words that come out of his mouth. Here's Senator Tim Scott.
I think Ronald Reagan gave us a great example when federal employees decided they were going to strike. Either you strike, you're fired. Simple concept to me, to the extent that we could use that once again, absolutely. The second thing I would do, though, is very important. This is probably not a well-known fact. The first thing, part of the challenge that we have today with President Biden is, and I don't mean this to be disingenuous, I mean this to be sincere. I'm not sure if the words are bought and paid for, but it's certainly he has been leased by the unions. And I say that because the first bill he passed, y'all remember the $1.9 trillion COVID relief package?
Yeah.
That only had 1% for COVID vaccines? It had $86 billion, I believe, for union pensions. Because they keep making these deals. And as a result of the deal, they promise too much, deliver too little, and the taxpayers pick up the tab.
Now, again, you've got the good senator there going on about, you know, well, we should fire those workers, you know, like Ronald Reagan did, hearkening back to the good old days when you fired those Patco workers and the shot heard across the boardroom that was open season on working people, you know, like it is in South Carolina. And then he goes on into the next thing saying, look, you know, well, you know, he's bought and paid for by those unions because they shored up the multi-employer pension funds in this country. Now, it's interesting. These are a lot of loans. This will get paid back, but he never bothers with that. And he also doesn't bother talking about the fact that we have bailed out banks and bankers and the wealth class for generations. It's socialism for the wealthy. It's hardcore, you know, do or die capitalism for working people. And I reach out to my union friends because I give Joe Biden credit for getting the Butch Lewis Act money pushed through and saving retirement for a generation, probably two. This is what angers Republicans. And the fact that that's on his mind tells you that he truly hates working people. These are the folks who want to go after Social Security. These are the people who want to gut Medicare. These are the people who are against it from the beginning. And the pension system. And the fact that he would say, you know what, we should just fire all those. Now, again, our law is workers have the right to strike. But that doesn't matter to them. They want pain and suffering for working people. And they're not shy in this moment about saying it. That's the part that's interesting to me. That they're willing to come forth and to our faces say, screw those working people. They should get what, as my wife always told the kids, you get what you get and don't throw a fit. If you don't like it, you can go somewhere else. You can go across the street where that guy's paying even worse. It's a very different mindset from what I believe and what I think Democrats believe. We have the ability, because this is, after all, a representative democracy. We have the ability to make change and to make better lives. And a lot of us think back to, you know, when things were good for working people. Where if you worked hard and played by the rules, you would actually get ahead. That there was something called an American dream instead of what has turned into a nightmare. And you know, I give these people who are walking these picket lines, I give them the ultimate credit. Like, I've done it in the past. It is difficult. It's difficult to walk across that threshold onto that picket line and know that you may not come back to work and that you're going to lose paychecks and that you're going to lose economic power in those moments and potentially, who knows? But you're fighting for something better. You're fighting to not just make yourself in this moment better, but the future better. You know, I back in 1994, we went on strike in the freight industry. And, you know, I tell guys now, back then, the industry wanted all part-time dock workers. All of the people who have the jobs loading trucks and unloading trucks and doing that stuff now in the unionized less than truckload freight industry. They are full-time jobs today. But in 94, they wanted to make them all part-time. They wanted to red circle the number of full-time people who were working in that moment. And then as they retired, they would just phase them out and they would all be part-time and no benefits. And in 94, we said, no, we care about the unborn. We care about the future worker who's going to take this job and want to support a family with it. And thank goodness we did, because those people who are working those jobs now are grateful for the full-time wages, the full-time benefits, the pension that comes with it. And that is what I want for everyone. So good on these workers. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, John Fetterman. Big fan of John Fetterman. John, I've known him for years. When he was mayor of Braddock, we used to have him on the program all the time. He issued a statement today, said, if those jagoffs in the House stop trying to shut down our government and fully support Ukraine, then I will save democracy by wearing a suit on the Senate floor next week. Because that's been the big one. That was the big issue yesterday, wasn't it? The big issue was, well, he's going to wear shorts and a hoodie. He's going to destroy the nation. While they're literally attempting to destroy the nation. Let's go to the phones. We got Steve in Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And I think you're dead on with regard to where conservatives are in terms of workers making any sort of meaningful progress. You know, that this is wash, rinse, and repeat. Yeah, I watched during COVID because my niece and nephew came to stay with me. Their parents tested positive, so they stayed with me for about a week. And they started watching some of the old Turner classic movies that I like. And, you know, one of the movies we watched was The Grapes of Wrath. And, you know, I'm sort of explaining them because they weren't terribly familiar with what happened during the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl and so forth, which the film centers on. And my nephew asked me, what are they talking about when they say Reds? I'm like, well, that was a way in which the powers that be would sort of slander the people who were standing up for workers' rights, for rights of the people, to not starve in the streets. And they would slander them by calling them Reds, i.e., you know, that they're communists, something akin to what was going on in the Soviet Union. And you see this over and over again. You know, when we were trying to pass the Affordable Care Act, you know, you remember the death panels and all of this? Well, I mean, I was convinced at the time, and I wrote about it, and fast forward, it turns out that it was true, that the Republicans were as much afraid of the precedent that would set as anything else. You know, it was a boondoggle for the insurance companies, but the idea that government can be responsible for more than simply just getting getting you out the police when you need them, or fire, or any of the other basic things that we think of when we think of government, or providing national defense. No, the government can actually help provide for education and health care and retirement and all sorts of other things, like they do in the rest of the developed world. So the fear was, if we actually passed it, people might start to getting used to this sort of thing. Who knows what else they might start to pass? Decent wages, decent retirement, pensions, and quality of life, and all of these things. And if that happens, then, you know, the super rich don't get to be super rich any longer. And we might have to actually share some of what we have. And that, again, that I think was the fear, that it's the precedent that it sets. And now, of course, you're seeing this revitalization of the union movement in this country that we haven't seen in decades. And you're seeing all sorts of progress on any number of fronts, and it scares the hell out of people. And, of course, you know, the only thing that you get from them, oh, well, you know, these people want to turn America into North Korea or China. You know, it's the Chinese Communist Party that's really pushing all of this stuff because they own Joe Biden. I mean, that's not a coincidence. You could try and tie Joe Biden to a lot of different elements, you know, around the world. But hey, the Chinese Communist Party, that's the one that might resonate, especially with older voters.
Yeah, because you can't use Russia anymore.
You can't use Russia anymore. Apparently, an authoritarian regime, when it was the Soviet Union, was the evil empire and had to be fought at all costs. But as long as they are no longer officially a communist country, then they can get away with anything, and we're willing to look the other way. As a matter of fact, we're willing to even support them in some ways. So, I mean, that's always interesting, you know. I mean, the Republican Party that was determined to fight communism, i.e. the Soviet Union, for decades, now you have a man in charge there in the Soviet, there in Russia, what used to be the Soviet Union, that was literally part of the KGB, and they don't care, you know. As long as they're not the communists that they used to be, we don't care. You know, we'll move on. It's China that's the threat now.
Yeah, as you were talking about the Affordable Care Act, I was remembering Michelle Bachmann. Do you remember Crazy Michelle? She laid out exactly what you said. She said that, you know, she's afraid that once people get, you know, much like Medicare, once people get it, they're going to want to hold on to it, and they're going to want to make it better. And that was my hope as well. It was my hope for the ACA was that we would make it better, because there are some problems with it, that we would get a hold of it, that people would, you know, say this is a good thing for us, and the Republicans have done a masterful job of gridlocking, of delaying, of repeal and replace with who knows what, 100 times plus, and we haven't made it better substantially, and we still need to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people, I've discussed and debated with people on this issue, and I don't know whether some of them are just ignorant of the history of this society, or are just, you know, out there to promote their vision of whatever propaganda is being fed to them. Yeah, I mean, I've had discussions where people will talk about, well, you know what, my grandparents or great-grandparents didn't have any of this stuff. Okay, so let's examine what period you're talking about. And we'll talk about Chicago in the early 20th century, late 19th century, you know, how horrible it was here. You know, this was the center of the meat packing industry, how horrible it was to work in those conditions. You know, The Jungle, one of the greatest books of its time, you know, about how terrible it was. You went to work when you were, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old. You died 40, 50 years later working. You lived in a shack. You had no indoor plumbing. You had no health care. You worked 6, maybe 7 days a week, 10, 12, 14 hours a day. And so the idea of how many people's lives were just wasted, consumed by this system. You didn't have any vacations to think about, or time off, or the weekends, or anything else. You went to work, you ate off what you made, and then you hoped that your kids had the same opportunity that you have, and that was it. We used up so many generations of people's lives in this country to build that great American dream that the people love to talk about. Like, well, this is what my grandparents did. Like, you want to say, did you ever actually talk to your grandparents or great grandparents? I mean, because trust me, they would not have that experience unless they were, you know, a part of the professional class or wealthy. Because I guarantee you, Chicago's a city of immigrants here, and that is not the experience that immigrants had their first and second generation being here.
No, my grandfather, he told me back in the late 20s, they were shoveling coal off the back of a coal truck for 17 cents an hour, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, and if you hurt yourself, if something happened, all right, well, move off of the line, go home, pick up what you earned so far, somebody else comes in.
Yep.
Hey, you got whatever, you know, you broke something, you have frostbite, it's 5 below out here, your problem, not ours. I mean, is that the America that we want to live in? No, the idea here is that we're supposed to be making progress towards something better.
No, Steve, that's not the American we want to live in, but that is the America that our Republican friends want to move us back to. They want to take us back to the Lochner era. They want to take us back to an era where if you were hungry enough and desperate enough to work in deplorable conditions for poverty wages, that was your freedom. It was your liberty. Liberty of contract was a thing for a long time where, hey, if you want to work 100 hours, you know, for no wages, that's your freedom. Even though you didn't have a choice, how you had to feed your family.
Yeah, that's the libertarian mantra. So for people who don't know it, so in other words, it's perfectly fine for a few people at the top to conspire to fix wages and to deny unions and all of this sort of thing. But if workers do it, that somehow infringes upon the free market. So if I gather together with all of my buddies who are working in a factory, we say, you know, we're going to unionize, we're going to hold out for more. That interferes with the free market. But it's perfectly fine to create all sorts of systems that prevent average people from elevating themselves out of poverty. No, that's fine. You can do that. It doesn't infringe upon the free market at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary times. And I'm sure you saw the New York Times piece today on the child labor violations that are going on in Virginia. A 14-year-old kid had his arm shredded at a Purdue slaughterhouse. In Virginia last year, and everybody covered it up. The police, the community, because the slaughterhouses would not operate without child labor, according to the report.
Absolutely. And what happened was, especially during COVID, I mean, let's face it, we were all sitting at home, and we wanted, you know, we wanted to keep ordering from the restaurants, or we wanted to get our food, including our meat, delivered. And we didn't really care about where it was coming from. You know where it was coming from? It was coming from a lot of people that we want to vilify as being here illegally, undocumented, and so forth. And they were the ones still working. They, you can't do that job remotely.
Yeah.
Some people still had to go to work, and those people did. And during that time frame, you know, we just let corporations get away with anything. So, okay, we need somebody. Okay, 14-year-old, put a 14-year-old on that line. We would never tolerate some suburban kid, you know, here in Chicago, who should be in high school working on that kind of line. But we tolerate it if it's the other, if it's some strange immigrant that, well, shouldn't be here anyway. So they should consider themselves fortunate to have any kind of a job.
Yeah, I'm with you, Steve. I appreciate the thoughts. Good stuff. No, but this is one of these things that there are people who want to take us back to the good old days. And those good old days weren't that great for working people. You know, the slaughterhouses that worked during the pandemic, and as Steve was laying out his thoughts, I was remembering that, you know, you had management who were taking those others and betting on how many of them they could get COVID and how many of them would die and how many... This happened. So for me, this is very cut and dry. I look at the people who are telling us, the Nikki Haley's, the Tim Scott's, that we'd fire those workers and that they're greedy and it's all Joe Biden's fault. And, you know, trying to whip up that hysteria. Which side of this are you on? As I say all the time, I'm on the side of the working people. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I've been saying for years, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. And now, look at what they're saying. You know, as I've been saying for the past couple of days, you got Nikki Haley going, you know, it's all Joe Biden's fault. When you tell people they can unionize, they do. And they fight for wages, hours, and conditions. And they want better. See, we need to kick them with those pointy-toed shoes that she so told those Walmart shareholders she wore to kick unions when she was governor of South Carolina. And now you got Tim Scott saying, fire them all. Yeah. So when do we throw these bums out? Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the latest revelations. I've asked Noah Leonard to come talk with us. Noah's a reporter over at Mother Jones Magazine. He's got a piece out. Nikki Haley and Tim Scott are here to remind you, Republicans hate unions. Noah, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on. Yeah, this is one of those ones where you don't, the headline doesn't make it too ambiguous for you. It cuts straight to the point. But yeah, like you said, this week was, I was actually surprised, not by that's maybe what they would say in private, but that's what they're saying in public as presidential candidates in 2023. I mean, you had Tim Scott saying basically fire them all if that's legal. Obviously, he was unaware that it is not legal and you cannot fire private sector workers en masse, willy-nilly. And then, yes, you have Nikki Haley, I mean, just saying, I was a union buster as governor. You know, that's her quote. So, not making it subtle at all. And it's also happening at the same time that you have Donald Trump kind of making a very hollow and phony play for union voters by going to Detroit next week. So there's at least a contrast in message, if not in substance, this time around on the Republican side.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting when the debate is going on, because Trump has said he's going to go to one of the picket lines, I guess the picket line in Michigan, on the date of the debate. It's going to be interesting to listen to the people who are on stage bashing workers and bashing unions, especially the UAW, and then Trump trying to walk that line. I thought his comment was quite interesting. You know, he kind of wanted to support the striking workers, but then attacked Sean Fain and the leadership because they've sold him out. They've sold them out. It seemed like, well, one of the most Trumpian things ever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. You know, he's playing both sides. I mean, he's definitely, you know, for all the other things you can say about him, he's a savvy operator in certain respects. And this is, you know, yeah, it's a smart move. He's going to be in Detroit, speaking to current and former union members, not just auto workers, but a variety. I'm not sure he could get 500 auto workers, you know, there, which is what they say they want, but we'll see. But yes, I mean, I also mentioned this in the article. I mean, the debate's happening at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. So, I mean, it really is like you could not ask for a better contrast and scenery of where these two things are happening. So you're going to have people in California at the Reagan Library talking about, you know, potentially talking about the firing of air traffic controllers in the PATCO strike. and Trump doing whatever he's going to do, which is not going to be to support the union's demands, I assume. Really, it's going to be to do this wedge that he's driving. And one thing about that is it kind of does, even though it's a smart political play, but it reminds me a lot of what you see in union busting campaigns is, you know, drive a wedge between the members and their leadership. It happens all the time. You know, the company will say, we love unions, support unions, just not this one. Right. And that's, you know, Trump's not exactly doing that, but it's a version of it.
No, no, the right does that masterfully. I know some conservative think tank people who they play that. You know, we don't hate unions, just all of these. All of the ones that are out there. But we don't, you know, conceptually. But, you know, what I'm interested to see is when he goes to Michigan, will he attempt to revive the Lordstown lie? I mean, are we going back to that? Because if you remember, he told all those auto workers, you know, don't sell your house. Don't take those job transfers. Don't follow the work anywhere else. We're saving Lordstown for you.
Yeah.
And, well, it's the Lordstown lie.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would definitely, I mean, obviously, we know Donald Trump is not concerned at all with sticking to facts, even remotely. So I would completely expect that. And even the line that he's taken on this, like, obviously, there's a lot of legitimate and real concern about how the transition to electric vehicles is going to affect auto workers and UAW members. We all know that. But I mean, the idea of what Trump's thinking here doesn't really make much sense. He's just saying all electric cars, he said, automatically will be made in China, which is not what's happening here. I mean, Joe Biden is promoting a lot of EV manufacturing, and there's concern that those factories are going to be in right-to-work states, and many will be. But, like, we're not, you know, there's not this future that Donald Trump is imagining where all the electric vehicles are made in China doesn't really make much sense, and also doesn't fit with what our policy is right now.
But if we have someone in the White House, if we have a set of politicians who open up our borders to Chinese EVs, we will, because there are like 25 million of them just sitting over in China waiting for a market to be dumped into. This is where, you know, having politicians who aren't going to sell us down the river, kind of important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's definitely a world in which this could go really poorly for auto workers beyond the just difficulties we know about already in terms of the potential, you know, fewer workers needed to make these vehicles because of just, you know, how the technology works. So it's very concerning for, you know, for the auto industry and auto workers, how this could shape out. I mean, I think it's been interesting to see Biden kind of and the administration kind of change tune. You know, you had these initial loans go to Ford for $9 billion with kind of no strings attached on worker protections, unionization, or anything. And of course, justifiably, you know, there was huge blowback from the UAW on that. And then you saw earlier this month that a new round of, you know, loans and grants were announced, and that they had kind of reconfigured it. They put out the announcement just in time for Labor Day, saying basically, you know, in a way it was a version of mea culpa, like, we heard you and we're not going to keep pulling this again.
Now, I do want to go back to Nikki Haley's comments.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because she gives credit to Biden. You know, says, look, you know, he's responsible for this. He's promoted unions. He's said go, 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 and they've done this. I think this is a great campaign ad, because I don't know, being on the side of working people and promoting better economics for working people, I don't know that's a bad thing. Now, I know who Nikki Haley was talking to. I know who Tim Scott was talking to. It's not the people who were doing the jobs, you know, building cars or plowing fields. It's the CEO class. It's the folks who at the big three pocketed a 40% wage increase over the last 4 years. Those are the people they're talking to. So my thought and my hope in this is that we pay attention and actually listen to the words coming out of their mouth.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And I was just pulling up while you're talking, you know, one of the direct quotes from this is, yeah, I mean, she said, you know, in this interview, but when you have a president that's constantly saying, go union, this is what you get. And, you know, in a world in which this works out well for the UAW, and they get a strong contract, and, they, you know, as Biden and the union have said, record profits does mean a record contract. I mean, yeah, it's a very good, definitely something for Biden to be running on. And I also think it's interesting in her remarks, too. It's like this distinction she creates between, you know, taxpayers and union members. She was saying, you know, if taxpayers were offered a 20% raise, I'm sure they'd be thrilled, basically saying these greedy, good for nothing union members won't take 20%. And of course, it's BS. And, you know, in the sense, this is 20% over 4.5 years happening after years of high inflation. No COLAs are part of that. But yeah, this idea that union members are not taxpayers. At the same time, these companies are paying basically nothing in federal taxes. So they're, I mean, they are not really taxpayers.
And this is one of those things that I talked about the other day, because you bring up this idea of union members and taxpayers. Oddly enough, union members pay higher taxes because they make more money. So the more they earn, the more they pay. That's how our system works. What's happened over the years is wages have been so stagnant. And, you know, when Mitt Romney, you remember back in 2012, he got hammered for saying 47% of the people pay no federal taxes. And I said, you know what? Those 47% of people would love to pay taxes. They would jump for joy to pay taxes because it means that they'd be making more money. For me, this is one of those moments where we should be flipping the script on this and saying, look, yeah, I'd be happy to pay more taxes if it meant I had more money in my paycheck.
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. I mean, workers would be thrilled in this case to be paying more taxes and to be able to do this. I mean, it's kind of, absurd at this point. And I get into some of this in the article, but it just doesn't even make sense where this is coming from. I mean, it's a problem for Democrats, but 40% of union members are estimated to have voted for Republican Donald Trump in the last presidential election. So, you know, why you have a presidential candidate getting out there and saying this? I mean, they're like, it makes no sense politically. And, you know, it's kind of shocking just how easy it is for Donald Trump to run away with this primary, given the quality of the opposition he's up against in terms of strategy. And these also just aren't any union members. These are workers from the biggest industry in a key battleground state that Trump has won before and almost won a second time in 2020. It's pretty mystifying, but maybe that also explains why, where Nikki Haley is in the polls.
I somewhat understood union members voting for Trump in 2016. I did. I somewhat understood it. It wasn't the racism. It wasn't the homophobia. It wasn't the misogyny. That's not what got them to vote. Now, for some, obviously it did. But I think for union members, it was especially, auto workers and industrial workers, it was the hope that Trump would do what he said and bring back manufacturing. Basically what Biden is doing right now, they hoped Trump would do. All the Lordstown lie, I go back to this. All of those people who believed that Trump alone could have saved that plant. And look, I remember driving past the Lordstown plant, when I lived in Cleveland, and you would see, 1,000 cars in the parking lot packed, morning, noon, and night. And now it's got a couple of little trying battery things or something in there, employs a couple of people. Those folks needed, wanted, and hoped those jobs would stay. And Trump told them, I alone can do it. And he lied.
Yeah, I mean, it's especially after, being ignored in so many ways over the recent decades, if someone comes around saying they're going to do something for you, you can see why it's a potent message. But I'm glad you brought that up too. And I'll write another piece for next week before Trump's speech. But I mean, it is easy just to forget how terrible his administration was for unions. I mean, even though it was only, 2-3 years ago, I mean, it was just atrocious. I mean, what the National Labor Relations Board was doing, one of the things I think that really captures is the Chamber of Commerce going into 2016 had made a list of their top 10 priorities that they wanted to see labor get done in labor in a Republican presidency. Trump did all 10 and did them quite quickly.
Yep.
This was a wish of the shopping list for the Chamber of Commerce and business groups. And, you have Antonin Scalia's son being the labor secretary, his original pick being a fast food executive. I mean, it's a joke. I think it's easy. It gets missed a lot because I think sometimes the media can focus too much on, will his strategy work or won't it, as opposed to the substance of what did he actually do when he was president?
No, I mean, you're spot on. Our media looks at the horse race and tries to figure out, how to do the both sidesism. And, someone told me today, if Trump had murdered a puppy on stage, the headline would be, Trump murders puppy. Here's why it's bad for Joe Biden. I mean, or here's why it's Joe Biden's fault.
Yeah. And without, being a partisan about it or, saying he's perfect when he's not. I mean, it is also worth remembering the flip side is it's not just that Trump was very bad for unions, is that Joe Biden, for the most part, you could point to some exceptions, has been unusually good for a Democratic president, especially when it comes to the National Labor Relations Board.
Yep.
And union organizing.
I said this before and I'll stand by it. If he did nothing but appoint Jennifer Abruzzo as the head of the NLRB, I'm happy with his administration. Now you throw in all the accomplishments, the rescue plan, the infrastructure bill. You know, you throw in all of the things that have come around that. That just makes it so much better. But the people that he's put into positions of power to help undo some of the damage of the past, to help us get an opportunity to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions, I'm thrilled with it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's a lot to be happy with, and there's more. You know, we're still not through this administration. So I think that, and sometimes he's like, you know, there's a lot of discussion now, and I think it can be important and not to dismiss it, but like, you know, will he go to the picket line or will he not, Joe Biden? And, you know, it's easy. There's, you know, in a lot, some ways, you know, a lot of what's more substantive than that is what his Department of Labor, what the Labor Relations Board is doing. And, you know, I think that often doesn't get a lot of coverage. It's not, you know, it's not the thing that is often focused.
I said from the beginning, I think he borrows Obama's comfortable shoes because Obama promised us that he was going to walk a picket line. He had comfortable shoes. He was going to do it. Never broke those out. Maybe Biden can borrow him and walk the line, or at least maybe send Obama to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And one thing on this, you know, I'm saying, you know, kind of my views here, and, you know, but I would also add, you know, if there are any auto workers, particularly on strike, but any UAW members of the big three listening to this, I'm eager to talk to as many of you as possible. So, you know, I'm easy to find on motherjones.com or on Twitter. So yeah, eager to get your perspective, you know, confidentially or on the record as well.
Now we're going to be heading, we at the program, we're going to be heading there this weekend out to Toledo on Saturday and up to Wayne on Sunday, depending on what happens. I mean, if they shuffle things around, we'll move where we need to go, but we want to go out and do as many, you know, have as many opportunities to talk to people, because ultimately we're in a which side are you on moment in this country. At least I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I also think like it's just been amazing to watch, you know, Sean Fain, and I guess I should say full disclosure, I'm a UAW member as well through our union, but like to see Sean Fain and the way he's framing this, it's so refreshing. It's not the kind of rhetoric you hear from just very much anymore. You know, talking about like, yes, we don't like this economy and we're going to wreck it, and there's just kind of no ifs, ands, or buts about it. But he's also, you know, yeah, and turning to scripture to make his case. I mean, it's. Yeah, I mean, it's been pretty amazing to watch him go about leading this strike as well.
No, what I like that he's done is, you know, one of the frames that we use here on the program all the time is, you know, it's not red hat, blue hat, it's up, down. It's not right, left, it's up, down. It's always been up, down. No. They force us into red hat, blue hat, left, right. They force us into, so we eat each other. He's saying, look, you know, when it was said that Trump was going to show up, he goes, you know, he's the kind of person that we're going after. We're going after billionaires, the kind of person that he is. And I thought that was the right frame.
Yeah, no, I was interested when Trump was initially saying something. I was, you know, I wondered what they would say. Would they say, you know, we welcome any support. We're not taking sides, you know, because obviously, you know, members have a wide range of political views and a wide range of attitudes towards Trump. But it was fun to see them come out immediately and just say, basically, screw this guy. He's a billionaire. And that's exactly what we're against.
Yeah, a good piece, though. I hope folks will take a look at it. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at it. I think you guys are doing great work over there at Mother Jones. But the piece, Nikki Haley and Tim Scott are here to remind you Republicans hate unions. And the Rick Smith Show will tell you Republicans hate working people. Just look at what they do. MotherJones.com, the website. Noah, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Good stuff, man.
Of course. Thank you.
Noah Leonard, again, make sure you check out the work that he does over there at Mother Jones. Gonna take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around and listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1830. That was the day that the Reverend Richard Allen brought black leaders together at his Mother Bethel AME Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They met to discuss the rising white violence and discrimination toward black free residents in northern cities. 40 people answered Allen's call, representing 7 states. The delegates included many of the leading black ministers and abolitionists of the day. Those who attended risked personal harm as white mobs threatened the delegates. Due to the danger, the group met in secret starting on September 15th. Then, on this day, they began open sessions. For 5 days, the delegates considered multiple responses to the conditions black Northerners faced. They founded the American Society for Free Persons of Color for improving their conditions in the United States, for purchasing lands, and for establishment of a settlement in the province of Canada. The organization emphasized pushing for legal protections for black residents in the United States. They focused on education as a means of uplifting and improving the lives of black citizens. But delegates also supported the idea of an outlet to Canada for those black families who wanted to leave for their safety. The National Convention reconvened several times over the next 3 decades. Multiple meetings were held at the state and local levels. These meetings gave black leaders a chance to devise coordinated strategies to stand up against the increasing violence and restrictive laws of the North and to call for an end of slavery in the South. One outcome of these meetings was the founding of labor schools to train black students in the skilled trades as a means to gain economic independence. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, I'm going to use a boo-boo word here. So if you're easily triggered, stick your fingers in your ears for about the next 15 seconds, because this is bad. It's bad. Evidently, there's a new book out on Rupert Murdoch, Michael Wolff's new book. According to the Daily Beast, Rupert Murdoch described Sean Hannity, Fox's host, as, he said he's retarded, like most Americans. And it's interesting that that's the word that they used for Sean Hannity and for most Americans. You know, the people who watch the F channel? That's what Rupert thinks of the people who watch his garbage. You surprised? Not even a little bit. Some really great news coming out of my state of Pennsylvania. I got to tell you, really like Josh Shapiro as governor. Going to be a great president one day. But Pennsylvania announced yesterday that we will become the 24th state to implement automatic voter registration. You will automatically be registered to vote when you renew your, when you get a new license or you renew your license. Automatic. You have to opt out. If you don't want to vote, you got to go, hey, no, not me. I'm not voting. And there are some people who still think that that's how they choose people for jury duty. And they'll be dumb enough to go, no, I don't want to. But this is a big deal. This is, a jab at the Mastrianos of the world. Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane. So what I wanted to say was, you know, the right wing is just losing their mind over this UAW strike. And in the Washington Post, yesterday there was a couple of op-eds, and then today that George F. Will, and he's like a nut job, wrote one, and the UAW can strike, but it's running out of gas. You know, and then they're going on and on, you know, how basically the union's bad and they're greedy. And I'm thinking to myself, people actually believe this that are on the right wing. I don't know what, you know, where the brains are, because they're believing this stuff. And yet some of them are working in the same fields where there are unions. Because I know a couple, and they're like, well, yeah, and this always cracks me up. Well, I'm not worried about that because we have a union, and even though I don't belong to it. And I'm like, just looking at them going, really? So in one breath you're saying the union's bad, and in the next breath you're going, but don't fight for me.
Yeah, because they don't have to, because they have to.
It's just insane. But you have a good evening, Rick.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. No, the reality is, and this is where, you know, I'm hoping in this moment, you know, we're able to have a national conversation around, you know, what Republicans are really out loud saying. They're saying that they want workers to work for poverty wages. They are saying out loud to our faces that you're not worth a decent wage. It's what they're saying. Nikki Haley, the union buster governor, was quite happy to say out loud in front of people that she didn't want unions to come in and change the environment, which means the workers of South Carolina are quite, you know, they're quite happy working for virtually nothing. They're happy working for poverty wages. They're happy making shareholders billions of dollars and with no protection whatsoever. They're saying this stuff out loud. And look, you know, the scary part of this is a lot of the new manufacturing is ending up in states that are run by people like Nikki Haley, are going to red states. Because wouldn't you, if you think about this, if you had the chance to avoid unions and workers saying, hey, I want a fair share of what my wealth, what my work creates, you can go to a place where you have absolute dictatorial control. You can hire and fire at will with no one to hold you accountable in any way, shape, or form. You are the king of the castle. Wouldn't you do it? This is what corporate America has been getting away with. And the reason, again, how horribly broken our labor laws are. Workers in the South want to organize. Don't be fooled by the rhetoric. They want to unionize. They want to have a better life. It's just the laws are so badly stacked against them. Look at what happened in Alabama at the Bessemer Amazon plant. All of the harassment, the intimidation, the constant berating of these employees. But something good happened. The NLRB ruled in the CEMEX case that, you know what? If you violate the law, if you break the law, no more. Oh, posted notice. No more. Promise not to do it again until the next time you do it. Now they're saying we're just going to impose union recognition. This could be a game changer, especially in the South. And again, this is why I'm a big Joe Biden fan. And I think you should be too. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Make sure you grab the podcast wherever you find your favorite podcasts. You'll get ours. Quick break. Right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Saturday, we're going to be making our way to Toledo to cover the strike. And we'll see what happens on Friday, because I'm told that, you know, everything could be up in the air. Things could completely change. They could have an agreement by then. And let's hope that happens. Let's hope they get what they are fighting for. But we'll be in Toledo on Saturday and Sunday in Wayne, Michigan, to talk to workers. Because this is an opportunity to change, well, to change the working class and the dynamics of that have been stagnating wages for far too long. And that's why I've asked Jim Rowe to come talk with us. Jim is a UAW Local 12 member, one of the strikers out in Toledo, one of the guys who made my Jeep, which I love, by the way. Jim, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Let's start there. You guys built my Jeep Wrangler, which I got to tell you, I absolutely love. One of the best quality vehicles I've ever owned.
Nice. Yep. We only one place that builds the Wrangler. That's Toledo.
And it's the reason that I bought it. Well, two reasons. One, I always wanted one. And two, it is mostly sourced here in this country. Union built, union made, American product. This is what we should be doing all across the economy, ensuring domestic consumption, domestic production, domestic consumption.
Right. Buy American.
There you go. So let's, why are you here? You know, why are you guys on strike? What's going on? Walk me through.
Well, we, we've given up concessions quite a bit over, actually my 39 years here. We've always, we've done what's needed for the company. And they've taken from us. And in 2009, when we hit bankruptcy, we really got hit hard. We gave up concessions. We gave up pension. We gave up wages. A lot of times, we just had to keep giving things up. We've been bought by 6-7 different companies. And now we're with Stellantis. And they're making billions of dollars. And they're not, we have profit sharing, but we've been stagnant at our wages for years. And it's time to give back.
Now, walk me back 39 years ago when you started at Jeep. You know, what was it like back in the good old days? Because, you know, I remember, you know, we're probably right around the same age. I remember those jobs were the gold standard of the American working class. Those were, you know, you got a job at Ford or Chevy or Chrysler or any of those places. That meant you were going to have superior wages, excellent health care, a defined benefit pension that you were going to be able to retire with some dignity on. It was the gold standard. Yes? No?
Yes, it was. It was in Toledo, and I'm assuming everywhere else that had the automobiles factories. You died for a job at Jeep, and if you got one at Jeep, you were lit. It was a great paying job. It's done great for my family. But we've had to keep giving concessions back to them. Back when I started in 1984, it was a great job, great wages, and we just kept going and going and. It's just stagnant on the wages. It's time.
That's been not just the auto industry, though, Jim. That's been almost every industry. I spent all my working life in the LTL trucking industry, and it was the same thing. You got one of those jobs, you know, at Roadway or Yellow or, you know, CF or any of those companies that are now all gone. Those were good, solid wage jobs with excellent benefits. It was a career job. Now they've turned into, well, you know, the old frame of Mick Jobs. I just looked at the wages that you're paying starting workers at this place. It's disgraceful what's happened to your industry.
It is. The starting wage at $15.78 for our workers, and then topping out at $19.78 is... It's disgraceful. You can go other places and get jobs that make much more money than that. Sometimes McDonald's around here is hiring for $18 an hour. And when you're at a Jeep plant and you're building Wranglers and you're making $15.78, I have friends that are SEs, supplemental employees. They've been there 6 years and they're stuck at $19. And that's not a wage that you can live on. They all have second jobs.
Yeah. And this is that moment, you know, because I keep seeing in the media, and I don't know if you're seeing the same things that I see, is, you know, our corporate controlled media is looking at you guys, well, you're just greedy. You you want a 40% raise? How dare you ask for something like that? Walk me through why that's not ridiculous.
A 40% raise is really nothing over 4 years. I mean, I make $30 an hour, and you're getting what, a $3 raise, and they're getting when the CEOs are getting 40% raises, which is $29 million a year, to our nickels that we're asking for. I mean, it's a slap in our face.
And the thing is,
The thing is
that what you guys do, and I've known people who've worked on the assembly line. I grew up in Cleveland, where you had a Ford and a Chevy plant, and I knew people who worked in those plants. This is hard, difficult, body-destroying work, as I understand. I know things have changed, and we've automated a little bit more, but this is still hard, difficult work that is destructive to the human body. And for $15-$18 an hour, I'm sorry, I don't know that it's worth it.
Rick, it's not worth it. You're in our plant alone, we're building a Jeep every minute. And you're putting on 6-7 parts on a Jeep, and you're bending and twisting, and your hands are aching, and you're hurting when you go home. And that $18 ain't worth destroying your body. You know, it's back in the day when we worked. Yeah, it was, you had time to build the Jeeps. Now they just want more and more and more, and they're not giving anything to help us get to want us to do that.
Now your president Sean Fain has said that, and I love the frame, that, you know, if they don't want to give up the wages and the benefits that they're asking for, maybe the shareholders can learn how to build the cars. Because I saw a number, and maybe you can help me with this, that the big three over the last decade have made $250 billion in profit, that they've bought back $66 billion worth of their shares, and that this year alone, something like $23 billion in profit, and they're not wanting... It seems like there's greedy going on. It just doesn't seem like it's you.
Correct. They've over the last decade, they've made trillions of dollars. And just this first 6 months of this year, they've made $29 billion. And still, they could give us our raises and our cost of living back and still make billions of dollars.
Now, what do you say to the person who goes, well, if they give you everything you want, the companies will get into trouble and go bankrupt, and well, that's just bad for the industry?
Never. They would not go bankrupt. They, like I said, we're building 1,000 Jeeps and Jeep trucks a day, and we can't keep up with orders. Stellantis is making so much money, and like I said, when you're making billions of dollars in the first 6 months of the year, they're not going anywhere. And as far as car prices going higher, that's just the media talking that up. Car prices shouldn't go higher.
So, you know, this is one of those moments where you go, even if the companies did get into trouble, the first thing they would do is come back and beg you for wage concessions and destroy your standard of living right now.
Sure. That's their MO. I mean, every time they say they're in trouble, they either run to the government or they come back to the workers and ask for concessions. And we give it because they're our paying jobs. That's our living.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Jim Rowe. Jim's a UAW Local 12 member, one of the striking workers, the big three at the Jeep plant in Toledo. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, what's the morale like? I mean, you know, as someone who's been a union member for over 30 years myself, I've been on strike before. I get a sense of how things are. What's the morale? What's the sense right now?
Morale is actually high, and we are very the solidarity right now is strong. We have in Toledo itself, I mean, we have the teachers union, we have the Teamsters, they're all backing us, our community leaders, our mayor. We have a very strong community backing, and our people are we're ready for the fight. We're standing strong and standing together.
You know, one of the things I've been saying for the last 2 years is I think we should adopt a striker program, that people should walk the picket line with you for a day. You know, bring a bottle of water, a pizza, something, maybe throw a buck into the strike fund, but actually walk in your shoes for a little bit and understand what it's like to be on that picket line. Hear the stories that you tell about what it's like inside that plant and the kind of work that goes on and the kind of treatment that you guys endure from management. Do you agree we should be engaging more with the community and bringing them in?
We should. That would be nice to, and it is happening here. We're getting a lot of people coming together and walking with us. They're coming from up in Michigan, the Ford people. We've gone up to Ford and walked with them. It's a lot of the other private industries are coming and seeing us. We got a lot of suppliers that are coming. You know, they're getting shut down. They're out there walking with us. And a lot of our SEs are out there bringing their families. You know, it's a great feeling. And when you get here Saturday, you're going to see, you're going to see a lot of camaraderie out there on the street and people driving by and honking, and it feels good.
That S word that we talk about a lot, solidarity. Maybe this generation's rediscovering it. Last line of questioning I've got for you, because you know we've talked about how when you started, this was the gold standard of employment for the working class. It has fallen considerably. If is this an industry you'd want your kids getting involved in? Would you want your kids to, in this moment right now, the way things are, would you want your kids working in this industry?
Actually, my daughter is a forklift driver here at the Toledo Jeep plant. And, you know, I really didn't want her to at first, but she's been there since 2014. And she bugged me about getting a job. She got a job there, and it's doing good for her. And the kids are coming around. It's when in 2013, when we started hiring people off the street, they had a different outlook on what it was about. And with the legacy workers being with them out here on the picket line, I think they're starting to come around seeing what it's all about.
Yeah. And I would argue probably, you know, the fight to get rid of the two-tier wage system probably is something that's bringing you together instead of doing what it's been doing and tearing you apart.
Yes, that wage system has to go. It is not fair for somebody to stand next to me and make $15, $16, $17 an hour while I'm making $30 an hour and they're working just as hard as I am and busting their body up just like everybody else. That needs to go.
Jim, I wish you the best. One day longer, one day stronger. I look forward to seeing you on Saturday. I hope you'll be there. But
yes, I will. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Jim Rowe, UAW Local 12 member there in Toledo. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Up the top.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-866-416-7425. Want to hear your thoughts. You know, there was a New York Times piece today that grabbed my attention. It talked about this 14-year-old Marcos Cox literally had his arm shredded at a Purdue slaughterhouse in Virginia last year. And what the report goes into, what this story goes into, is that this place is full of migrant child labor. Now, remember, these are the people that we're demonizing that are providing our food. And what's interesting, you know, the report pointed out that if they were to pay like $2, like $2 or $3 more per hour, you would actually get people to work there. But since they pay, you know, basically poverty wages for really difficult, hard, back-breaking, finger-breaking work, you know, people aren't gonna take those jobs. And as long as they got an endless supply of cheap labor and, you know, migrant children, they're going to continue to do it. And as this woman wrote in the story, that, you know, everybody knows it's the dirty little secret everywhere. Now, understand, these packing house jobs, these used to be really good union jobs. We're talking, you know, 80s, late 70s, 80s, you know, maybe even into the 90s. These were really good jobs. And all of these big, you know, these huge conglomerates, these monopolies, went in and destroyed the unions. And what it brought was desperation. And I remember talking to a worker, and this is probably going back about 10 years. I remember, you know, a woman, I think she was in Mississippi. And she said that, you know, in the food processing plant that she worked in, they had on the walls of the break room dispensers for any kind of, you know, aspirin, you know, painkillers, whatever you wanted, they had, because you couldn't get through the day without just drugging yourself up to get through the numbing pain, the searing pain in your hands and your back from doing this kind of work, and for desperation wages. That's the other part of it. Look, you know, if you're going to go out there and you're going to make a good living, you know, and this is, I had someone who worked at the Chevy plant explain this to me. He goes, look, I walk out of that plant every day exhausted. I walk out of that plant every day broken and my body being destroyed a little bit more every day. But I know that my kids are never going to have to. I know that I'm making the kind of living that's going to give them opportunities that I could have never imagined. And look, you know, when I went into the freight industry, it was the same thing. You did hard, back-breaking labor, but you made a good wage that said, you know what? My kids aren't going to have to do this. We're going backwards. And the reason I asked Jim, you know, do you want your kids working in this industry, is, you know, I look at these meatpacking plants. I look at the fact that we're now going backwards. And it's outrageous. And in the story, she talks about, you know, this 14-year-old kid basically just having his arm shredded. And they reported it to OSHA. It was a severe injury. And OSHA allowed them to self-inspect. And they never visited. Because remember, OSHA is so badly underfunded that basically all they go and check out are fatalities. So if you don't kill someone, if you just chop off an arm or two, well, that's, you know, that you can self-inspect and then, you know, promise not to do it again. Evidently, according to the report, the case was closed before the kid was even out of the hospital. There were no fines. There was nothing. And nobody bothered to mention that it was a child worker. So it all just kind of got swept under the rug. And as she points out, you know, the police knew, the community knows. But it's the big employer in the neighborhood. It's the big tax base. And this is, again, what happens when you have these monopolies. It's what happens when you don't have unions to protect people. You know, I go back to the pandemic. You know, you had in one of the meatpacking plants in Iowa, you had supervisors who were literally trying to get people sick, and they were betting on how many people they could get sick. And then you had, you know, meatpacking plants that were represented by unions. And I think of, you know, my friend Russell out in Washington, where the Teamsters represented, you know, food service workers, food processing workers. And immediately as COVID hit, they began taking safety measures. They redesigned workstations. They staggered start times so people weren't all waiting in line. They broke up lunch periods. They brought in trailers for people to have, you know, opportunities to have their lunch and be away from each other. They did all of the smart things to keep people safe. They were proactive because the workers had a voice. In those plants where they didn't, You literally had supervisors trying to get them sick. Now, of course, that's the worst of the extremes, and I understand that. But it happens. And the fact that we're seeing more of these child labor stories tells me the problem is much worse than we can even imagine. And as this article points out, the meatpacking industry, and this is I guess a sign of reality, they couldn't operate without migrant child labor. And that's Purdue, that's Tyson, that's Smithfield. Evidently, it's all of them. Now, what I found most ironic about the story is she said that evidently these companies passed out a picture of her telling workers not to talk to this woman because, well, you know, she's one of those bad people. You know, she spins a narrative. And the narrative is you're getting screwed. I had a friend today tell me that he went to, there's a big chicken processing plant here locally. And he said he went to go apply for a job. And he said he's never seen so much security at a chicken processing plant. He said multiple guards, multiple gates, all kinds of stuff. And you wonder, why are they doing that? Yeah, I can tell you why. They don't want anybody talking to their workers. They don't want anyone unionizing their workers. They don't want anyone putting a thought in their head that they're working their behinds off for poverty wages and that they could do better. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about, this strike, this UAW strike, could be one of those game changers. You never know in the moment. And I look at what Sean Fain, the president of the UAW, said last week. He said, look, this is our generation's defining moment. And he says, look, they're ready to stand up and they're ready to fight and demand better, to take on, you know, just corporate greed at such a high level, and even more than that, as we've been talking about, which got me to thinking, maybe we should look historically at what these strikes have been able to accomplish, what they've meant, and maybe we could be living a bit of history. And that's why I've asked my good friend Eric Loomis to come talk with us. Eric is the author of A History of America in 10 Strikes, the book every working person should, must, and absolutely has to read and have on their bookshelf. Eric, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, you know, could this be the defining moment of a generation, as Sean Fain says?
Well, it could be. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody's really aware at the moment in which it's happening what the defining moment is. You know, the history of social movements, whether we're talking about strikes or other social movements, is filled with things that seemingly happen out of nowhere. And then it becomes a bigger deal later. But I would say this, that, you know, it's very clear that the UAW is striking not just for, you know, the wages and things, and getting rid of the two-tier wage structure and those sorts of very concrete things. But it's quite clear that they're striking for the future of industrial labor in America. And it's happening at a moment in which there's a lot of concern over things like automation. There's the issue of where the electric vehicles are going to be built, and will they be built under the union structure. And I think that this is a moment in which it's quite clear that this is going to set the groundwork for what's going to come, not just over the life of this contract that they will eventually be signed, but over the next decade, two decades, three decades. I think that they're very aware of what's happened to the UAW and to unions generally in the last couple of decades, and they're looking to take advantage of the current era of sort of labor upheaval and to really make some concrete gains, not only for their members, but try to reset the framework of collective bargaining generally right now. So, you know, the answer is, of course, that we can't know, But I think there's a reason to think that that Fain and other UAW leaders and the rank and file are all pretty aware that this might well be, and it's and they have to act as such.
Now, in your book, The History of America and 10 Strikes, two of those 10 that you point out are UAW strikes. You get the sit-down strikes of the 30s, and you know, in the 70s, you had the Lordstown strike that went on. You know, and those really did change the direction of the country, I think, in the sit-down strike, very positive ways. I guess in both very positive ways. Walk us through, you know, that sit-down era. Do you think those people knew that they were fighting for the future of work, and they were fighting to create what became the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization, or were they just fighting to survive the next day?
I think it's a little of both. I mean, I think that those activists in the 1930s certainly had a historical vision. They certainly saw themselves as the vanguard of a working class that they hoped would take over America, and probably more than it actually did, although certainly they benefited themselves and all the other auto workers benefited from the kind of gains that they made. But, you know, when they're acting to engage in the sit-down strike, I mean, they're seeking to force the auto companies to bargain really for the first time ever. And so they're certainly aware that if this works, it's going to change the entire nature of collective bargaining, change the historical trajectory of auto workers and industrial laborers in America, which is, of course, exactly what it does. Right. And so the moment in which in which General Motors signs that initial agreement recognizing the UAW as the bargaining agent of the workers, this is a watershed moment in American history, not just labor history, but American history, because for the first time, one of these gigantic auto plants, which, remember, at the time, employed tens of thousands of people in some of these plants, that for the first time that these workers were going to have collective representation and going to be able to take their demands to the company and expect that there's going to be some reciprocation there and that those demands are going to be met. And so whether they saw, to the extent they saw themselves at the very moment of changing the trajectory of working class history, at the moment that GM caves, they certainly know that they've changed working class history.
And that benefited, you know, people across the board, because I've had some folks reach out and go, well, why do I care about this? It's just going to make... The response I'm getting from my MAGA hat wearing friends is it's just going to make cars more expensive. And I'm like, no, it's going to help raise the, you know, that rising tide thing. This is how that tide rises when workers share in the profits that their labor creates. And maybe this sends a wave across not just the auto industry, but all industry.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, in part, do we want workers to be able to afford the cars that they make? Right. And if they're making $16 an hour, which, you know, I mean, you know, so the starting wage for some of these UAW, some of these auto workers now is lower. You know, California just passed a $20 minimum wage for restaurant workers. It's lower than these restaurant workers' minimum wage now in California. This is not a good wage. And we've seen the slow rolling back of the kind of gains the UAW made. And this is a big reason why they are making such broad-based demands at this time, because they see what's been happening. They see this is going to continue to happen, that the purchasing power of working class people is going to continue to decline. And so, you know, they're trying to make a big stake against all three companies at once to try to reverse that. And, you know, the issue of whether or not it makes cars more expensive, I think that this is a kind of common thing, but that people who oppose unions or labor regulations say. But, you know, it is worth noting that a lot of the reason for the expensive cars is the choices that the companies make as well. On top of this, the kind of cars that they choose to make, the kind of pricing that they choose to engage in. And, you know, if people want to talk about cars being super expensive, let's also remember that the big three in the U.S. have largely given up the small car market entirely based on their own choices. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons why cars may be expensive today. Higher wages for workers, yes, that is can contribute. But of all things, that's the one reason that we should be supportive of cars being a little more expensive to know that those workers are going to pour all that money back into the economy. And it's going to help every single worker in America.
No, and this is, for me, this is what I see this being, you know, you, the historian, maybe can help me through this. What I see this possibly being able to do is wake up a working class that I've said is, you know, suffered from Stockholm syndrome for the last 40 years. As the work we do, wages have been stagnant, benefits have been declining, pensions have been eviscerated. You know, things have gotten worse for working people, and the anger out there is real. So when you see, you know, these big three who pocketed $250 billion in profit over the last several years, $21 billion in profit the first six months of this year. They're doing $5 billion in stock buybacks. When you see all of this money that's flowing to the handful of shareholders and CEOs and our oligarchy, I'm hoping this is that shake awake moment where you go, no, the prices don't have to go up. Maybe the money we give to the people at the very top, maybe that goes down a little bit.
Right. You know, I think it's a lot of this kind of Stockholm syndrome that you talk about, you know, is a response, I think, of a kind of a decline in this country of solidarity, even among various parts of the working class, that everybody's kind of looking out for themselves a little bit. And so, you know, the first concern that many people, including even often many other union members, might have when, say, the auto workers go on strike is, how is this going to impact me? And thinking just in terms of their, you know, their personal consumer choices, right? Not even in terms of the kind of bigger picture in which, you know, a stronger labor movement is going to help everybody. And so I think we need to really reinvigorate the idea of solidarity, the idea of mutual aid, the idea of having each other's backs, and the idea that, you know, as goes the major unions in this country, so goes the rest of the American working class. Especially when you only have 10% of the of American workers unionized at this point, that the unions oftentimes are setting wage and benefits rates even for non-union plants, and you know, and so if they don't have the power to do that, then it's going to hurt every single worker in this country. And I think that, you know, people whose first thought is, well, I was going to go buy this, you know, my new truck, and now I might have to wait. You know what? Maybe that's okay. Maybe there are bigger things that you should be considering right now.
Oh, no, you've hit on something I've been asking for the longest time. You know, what are you first? Are you a consumer or are you a worker first? How do you view yourself in this economy? And sadly, most people I know view themselves as consumers. Like you said, how is this going to affect me? Instead of how is it going to make life better for working people? It's, hey, hooray for me. And that's troublesome.
Yeah, there's no space in that world for any kind of solidarity. And moreover, when you are needing, you know, if you're a Teamster, you're a, you know, IBEW member, SEIU, whatever it may be, I mean, if you're not coming out and actively supporting other workers when they're in a situation that they're making bigger demands, why are they going to support you when you make your demands? Yep. They're not going to, right? That at the core of what solidarity means is not, I want you to do what I want you to do. It's literally mutual aid. Like that's the root of this. It's the idea that we as workers are going to assist each other to build up the collective power of the working class. And so I think it's really important to say, how can I help support this struggle?
This is why I've been saying for the longest time, every politician should adopt a striker, and every working person should find a picket line and adopt a striker, walk with them for a day, bring a pizza, box of donut, I don't know, anything, some water, whatever, maybe throw a buck in the collection fund to help people get through this, because, you know, their victory will be all of ours if we can begin to turn the tide on what has been just massive, not even shameful corporate greed. And begin to redistribute wealth, kind of like my grandparents' generation did.
Yeah, and this is why I think that, you know, the UAW is so historically minded in this current struggle, because they're aware of this, they see the future, and they also see the present inequality. And that's why I think tying their own wage gains to the gains made by corporate leaders in the last several years is a very smart rhetorical move. because they're pointing out that these CEOs continue to get these just skyrocketing salaries, and it's coming on the back of the workers. And so now the workers want theirs, right? The union members, they want theirs, and they want to, and they also, like, they want to continue to have an active and powerful UAW. They want those electric vehicles to be built in, under the union master contract. You know, they want to grow. And they want the companies to respect them as an organization. And I think that, you know, part of what they're doing here is trying to turn the tide on the last 40 years of American history, right? Ever since Reagan fired the air traffic controllers in 81, it's been an open warfare on American unions. And, you know, UAW leadership is trying to reverse that. And they are truly backed by an angry and activated workforce. That this is a strike in which the rank and file is not begrudgingly going out. Like, they want to strike, they want to push back, and I think that's part of the reason why this strike is so important for the rest of us, because it really is tapping in to the general anger in which many Americans, and the vast majority of which are not union members, feel about the contemporary economy. Well, you know, this is a group of workers that have the agency and the ability and the organization to actually take the fight to corporate America, which is why we need to support them.
And I'm right there with you. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, this is again another one of those moments where you go, a victory helps move all of us forward. You know, I'm looking at the administration. You've got the president who's, you know, some say is the most pro-labor president. At least he's the most pro-labor president of my lifetime thus far. How responsible is he for this, and should he walk the picket line?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. I mean, you have Michigan politicians saying, you know, maybe it's better for him to stay away. At the same time, he certainly wants to signal that he is pro-union, and he is pro-union. Now, we can disagree with some of the things that he's done, and that's fair and fine. He's got a lot of different issues here that he has to, you know, kind of balance, but you know, I personally think that Joe Biden needs to listen to UAW leadership, you know, and he should be, and his people, I know, are in contact with UAW leadership. I know Acting Secretary of Labor Julie Hsu, who has a very, very good labor record, to the point that, you know, she's only an acting secretary because, you know, corporate leaders in the Senate don't want to confirm her because they're scared of her. Is in Detroit, talking to people. And I mean, I think that Biden needs to say, look, like, I want to support the UAW. I want to do this in an intelligent way. Let's have a conversation with UAW leadership on what I can do. And I think that he's done some good things. He said some good things, but I'm not sure that UAW membership really buys it. So, I mean, I think that, you know, among the things that he can do is not only to speak out against some of the corporate greed that's going on, but to try to put his thumb on the scale a bit about building the electric vehicles in union plants. I think that's really important. You know, there's been all these incentives to build electric vehicles, but I think, frankly, that Biden's labor people and Biden's environmental people are not necessarily talking to each other. And so you have this deal that came out that did not really mandate that these that or really try to, thing that they can't mandate it, try to shape it a little bit to really incentivize the building of these EVs in union plants. And I think that was an error. And Biden's going to need to figure out how to fix that, because he needs to do something really strong, I think, to signal to not only UAW members, but to the American working class that he is their representative in Washington and not Donald Trump.
No, it's going to be interesting to see where this plays out. Eric, as always, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. Again, the book, A History of America in 10 Strikes, written by Eric Loomis. This is a must read, and it has to be on your bookshelf. Eric, appreciate the time, man.
As always, much appreciated.
Thanks so much, our good friend Eric Loomis. Again, the book. Make sure you get the book. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come on, talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1878. That was the day that socialist author Upton Sinclair was born in Baltimore, Maryland. A prolific writer, Sinclair wrote nearly 100 books and other publications. Upton Sinclair's father and father's relatives had been wealthy Southerners, but thanks to the Civil War and its aftermath, the family was left in financial ruins. His mother was from a wealthy Episcopalian family and was very strict. Sinclair often stayed with her wealthy parents. These family experiences growing up gave Sinclair an insight into how both the rich and poor lived. Sinclair studied at the City College of New York, and for a time at Columbia University. He went on to write several popular novels that explored the experiences of working people in the rapidly industrializing United States. The Flivver King explored the impact of Henry Ford on auto production. Oil focused on the oil industry in Southern California. But Sinclair is best remembered for his classic expose of the Chicago meatpacking industry, The Jungle. The book was fiction, but based in fact. In 1904, he spent 7 weeks working undercover in Chicago's meatpacking plants to get material for the book. The Jungle was published in 1906 and was immediately a bestseller. It was originally published in serial form in a socialist newspaper. Sinclair said that he wrote the novel intending to set forth the breaking of human hearts by a system which exploits the labor of men and women for profit. The novel led to congressional legislation and federal regulation of the meatpacking industry. It helped lead to the passage of the Meat Inspection Act and the Pure Food and Drug Act. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. So Hunter Biden pled not guilty to gun charges, and I'm still waiting for the gun nuts to all get behind him, because you would think Hunter Biden would be a right-wing hero. You know, you lied on a gun form, fighting with the IRS, doing the drug thing. What's interesting to me, and look, if he did it, he's got to be held accountable. You do the crime, you do the time. But I do find it interesting that little selective prosecution, because I've seen pictures of Dumb Jr. With giant guns. I've seen him with lots of guns, and there's a guy who he's got a problem. I would love to see his gun applications. Interesting story coming out of Georgia. Lynn Wood, Trump's former attorney, evidently can no longer practice law. He had to surrender his law license last week. But evidently it's turned out that he's going to, I guess, be a witness for the state. Uh-oh. Can you say the rat's about to start jumping ship? I'm waiting for Sidney Powell to be next. Rudy will never. Now, what's interesting, Rudy's name, again, being floated. Do you remember the whole, what was the Borat movie? Where he was in the room with the young woman, and he's laying on the bed, you know, with his pants down. And, it turns out, according to Cassidy Hutchinson, you may remember her. She was one of the people who was the star of the January 6th hearings. Evidently, in a new book, she's saying that Rudy groped her. She said he was like a wolf closing in on its prey. That's what the book says. And, you know, anyone shocked? Hutchinson said the former New York mayor turned Trump lawyer, put his hand under my blazer and then my skirt. She added, I feel his frozen fingers trail up my thigh. He tilts his chin up. The whites of his eyes look jaundiced. The eyes dart to John Eastman, who flashes a leering grin. This does not sound good. Where are the Q people? Yeah, never mind. I shouldn't even ask. Should not even ask. But some good news. It looks like Schumer has grown a set. They are moving to get some of the military promotions of at least the top three military people pushed forward. And in a pretty sizable vote, I think it was, what was it, like 83 to 11, if I remember right, of which Tuberville voted against promoting the military folks. And again, these are people who tell you how much they love the military, how they wrap themselves in the flag, all of that. It's shameful, especially as we're ticking down the days to the end of the month when a government shutdown seems all but certain. And you go, explain? I know they want their pound of flesh, and we talked about what it is they want. Last I heard, it was 8% cut across the board. And who does that hurt? That hurts poor and working class people. And that's the goal. I mean, that's the point. The cruelty really is always the point, isn't it? And it's one of those things where, you know, I was talking about a study yesterday that said, you know, people are just exhausted about talking about politics. It's this kind of stuff that wears people out. That we bring elected leaders in to do a job. They run on a platform saying, hey, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And they don't. You know, I look at Tim Scott, and I'm going to finish where I started. Tim Scott saying, you know what, we're going to fire, we should fire all those workers. If they go on strike, we should fire them. You know, how about we change that? If you don't do your job, we fire you. Passing a budget is your job. Not shutting down the government is your job. How about we fire them? This is the angering part of this, because we pay them good money. We pay the, you know, what about the, you hear Nikki Haley talking about, you know, the taxpayers. You know, we taxpayers should be infuriated by the fact that there is a Republican-led House that is in total and complete chaos. They can do nothing. Oh, well, that's not true. They do entertain and outrage the minions. But nothing's getting done. And I say this is by design. This is how it's supposed to be in Republican world. It's supposed to be broken so that you get frustrated. But now is not the time for frustration. Now is the time for action. Now is the time to get involved. And I know sometimes it can be exhausting. And sometimes it can be so frustrating. But we got an election coming up soon. You know, a big one, your local ones, your school boards, your local dog catcher, the stuff that affects your life each and every day. And then next year, we got a huge one to, you know, decide whether we're a democracy or not. To decide whether, you know, that Constitution thing means anything. Probably a good time to get involved. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Appreciate you tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.